Port.
There will be general elections across England this year, and it seems that pro-Palestinian candidates may just give pro-genocide Labour supporters a tough time in the ballot box. Labour leader Keir Starmer stated early on in the genocidal campaign that he supported the right of the Zionists to withhold food, water and electricity from Gaza, and his MPs may pay dearly for his fealty to Israel. In Rochdale, firebrand George Galloway is standing in the by-election to take the seat from Labour. In a fascinating twist to the story, his hand has been strengthened by an Israel lobby hit job on his Labour opponent, Azhar Ali. Tony Blair had Ali as an advisor on terrorism. Lancashire County Council called Ali a champion for the Prevent agenda. He and Harris Rafiq of the Quilliam Foundation also founded a group that was funded by Prevent. The Board of Deputies, which collaborates closely with the Israeli embassy, promoted the organization. But none of that was enough for the lobby, which demanded Ali's head on a plate for his private questioning of the October the 7th narrative. Azhar Ali being pushed out of the Labour Party has meant that Galloway does not have a Labour opponent in Rochdale. Another key battleground for pro-Palestinian parliamentary aspirations will be Ilford North, where Palestinian Leanne Mohammed will take on Israel lobby-funded Wes Streeting. Over the past years, Streeting has received funding for office costs from key Israel lobbyists Jonathan Mendelsohn and Trevor Shin. Streeting has also played a key role as an Israel lobby political hitman over the years. The poetic justice of his being removed by a descendant of the displaced Palestinians is just irresistible. Starmer himself is facing a challenge in his own constituency from former ANC MP Andrew Feinstein. Feinstein is the son of Holocaust survivors and served as a member of parliament in Nelson Mandela's government following his release from prison in South Africa. Starmer, who has done everything to support Israeli apartheid and now genocide in Palestine, may just get his comeuppance in the forthcoming elections.
Joining me in the studio, as usual, is our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and he's now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch, and he's a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. Our guest contributor today is James Giles, who's George Galloway's election agent in the upcoming Rochdale by-election, and I spoke to him earlier via Skype. Welcome to the show. David, I mean, do you think the Labour Party are going to pay an electoral price at the upcoming general election?
Oh, I certainly hope so, and I believe that's the case as well. I mean, the extraordinary thing about what happened in Rochdale, where the candidate was removed for having a slight difference of opinion or emphasis with the Zionist talking points, is amazing. I mean, if you or I were in the Zionist war rooms and we said, this guy's said something vaguely off colour, shall we get rid of him? What would we say? We'd say, no, he's our candidate. Yeah. I mean, who else is going to defeat George? And they've destroyed their own chances there. And of course, that's going to mean probably a victory for George in Rochdale. And of course, there's all sorts of pushback going on against the Labour Party. I mean, the debacle in the House of Commons about the vote on the ceasefire, which of course is entirely 100% Starmer's fault, isn't it? A real indication of how far they're willing to go to not just to push the Zionist entity's lines, but to actually take briefing from the President of Israel on matters of British parliamentary democracy. I mean, it's a real indication of the way in which Israel runs this country.
Sure. Well, I started by asking James if he felt that Labour had eaten itself effectively in Rochdale with their fake anti-Semitism codswallop.
It's quite unusual, isn't it, to have a campaign where pretty much every other player has left the field. Labour left the field with Azhar Ali, who said some very silly things. The Green Party left the field. Their candidate also said some very, I'm going to call them silly things. The Conservative candidate is on holiday in Egypt and won't be back until polling day. And as for Simon Danchuk, well, he was disgraced long before this by-election. So I think all of the other parties have eaten themselves, which is part, although not in full, why we are now the bookies' favourite to win in Rochdale. Well, look, if you'll forgive me for speaking candidly, Labour put forward a shortlist of two candidates. Azhar Ali, not a Rochdalian, someone who lives in neighbouring Lancashire, And Paul Waugh, the I journalist, who actually is one of my constituents here in Kingston-upon-Thames, where I'm the leader of the opposition. He, of course, was born in Rochdale, but has lived in Kingston for some time. And it was a choice between Azar or Paul. Look, I wasn't at the Labour meeting, but dare I say, they knew George Galloway was going to stand. I think Azar Ali was picked in a rush, largely to appeal to, so they thought, the sizeable Muslim population in the constituency. And just look how that has blown up in their faces.
David, I mean, with your victory in the courts and now this in Rochdale, I mean, do you think we're seeing a kind of a vindication of sorts for all those people that have been smeared for all these years?
Well, of course we are. I mean, the last 4 or 5 months, with the ongoing, very, very visible day-by-day genocide by the Zionists, that everybody now knows that the stuff that I've been saying, that many others have been saying about Zionism being racism, everyone knows this is true now, and no one has anything really to say about it. The Zionists just respond by coming up with lies. Oh, Hamas did this, Hamas did that. And they're even being satirised about it on TikTok by thousands and thousands of young TikTok users. So it's very clearly a vindication for all of us who are anti-Zionists. And but it's not just that. It's also the beginning of the end of Zionism, I think. Zionism as a project looks extremely unsafe now. And it's very, very difficult to see how it can win anything from this. It may stagger on for another few years, but it looks like it's the beginning of the end for the Zionist project as a whole.
Yeah. Well, I then asked James, what sort of George Galloway's day-to-day schedule was like in the run-up to the Rochdale by-election?
Well, look, no 2 days are ever quite the same in Rochdale. George will wake early and finish late, always in the office, no later than 9:30. Meeting voters, meeting business owners, meeting stakeholders, going out and fighting for every last vote, often not finishing until midnight. You must forgive the slightly scruffy state of me at the moment. I also fall into that trap. I haven't had time for a haircut, and most nights I don't finish until 2, maybe 3 a.m. together with a loyal band of volunteers. But that really is the beauty, if you like, of a by-election. But all I can say is, thank God it's only, 4.5 weeks long? Well, look, there's a wide number of issues in Rochdale. The media have been obsessed with Gaza, with Palestine, and, you know, rightly, a good section of the population have that as their primary issue in this by-election. But what the media aren't reporting is that the campaign is speaking out on a whole host of issues. Would you believe you can't be born in Rochdale? There's no maternity unit. You can't die in Rochdale either. There's no A&E. So we're campaigning to reinstate maternity services in Rochdale. Would you believe the town hall has had £20 million spent on it, yet the clock still can't tell the correct time on the town hall? I think that epitomises the state of the local authority in Rochdale, where youth services have been cut to the core, where they can't even find a bucket of tar to fix the seemingly endless number of potholes. I think if I could sum it up in one way, I would say that people are disillusioned with Labour locally, disillusioned with the Tories nationally. They're fed up of the political class, which is why they're looking afresh George, I'll end my answer to this question, I think, with this. The day before Azar Ali was suspended as the Labour candidate, the pipes burst in the Labour HQ. True story, I promise. And excrement was spilt from the pipes all over the leaflets of Azar Ali, an omen, if you like. And I think that is also the epitome of how Labour have run the town. There's excrement everywhere. The services are terrible. I would use the SH word, but I won't end it and I won't say it because it's not broadcastable.
David, just say a word or two, will you, about Wes Streeting and his links to the Zionist lobby. And do you think Leanne Mohammed could actually beat him in Ilford North, where she's been selected, obviously, to build a, you know, an insurgent campaign similar to what George has been doing in Rochdale?
Well, as we heard in the film there, Streeting has had contributions to his office costs from Trevor Chin, who is a well-known Israel lobbyist, and of course has been, attached directly to Starmer's staff. Effectively, he is the most senior officer of the Zionist movement in the UK, has been for some decades. And also, of course, from Lord Mendelssohn, John Mendelssohn, who, of course, was involved in the first Labour lobbying scandal under New Labour back in the late 90s. And of course, he's also involved with charities which are funding the IDF, Jewish supremacist organisations, indeed settlements in occupied Palestine. So we know that kind of link. But look, Wes Streeting was recruited to the Zionist movement many, many years ago when he was still in the National Union of Students. He travelled to the Zionist entity at the expense of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and took part in the Global Forum for Combating Anti-Semitism, the body which constructed the weapon to use against the left, which is fake anti-Semitism, the alleged identity between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. So he's effectively been recruited by the Israel lobby for many, many years, and that's his position.
Sure. Well, I also asked James about George Galloway's Workers' Party fielding more candidates in other constituencies.
Well, look, prior to this by-election, the party had already announced it was fielding 50 candidates in seats across the country at the next general election. If we win in Rochdale, and I believe we will win in Rochdale, I'm quite sure the party will explode in a good way, unlike Labour's candidate who imploded. I'm sure the party will see a flurry of new members, a flurry of new branches, and a flurry of new activity. And so who knows where that current 50 seat promise could end up.
Well, I'm just going to pause the discussion there for a moment for our second report. This one's about the role of the Labour Party leader, Sir Keir Starmer. He's vying to become the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. Yet on occasions, he seems to be prioritising Israel's interests over his own country's.
There were mass walkouts.
Westminster is known as the mother of all parliaments, but a recent attempt to vote on a ceasefire in Gaza seems to have been brought down by the underhanded skullduggery of Israeli assets within its halls. The SNP-drafted motion was scuppered by a last-minute intervention by Labour leader and pro-Israel enforcer Keir Starmer. Having consulted Israeli President Isaac Herzog, Starmer devised his last-minute plot to ruin the motion. The services rendered by Sir Keir Starmer to the genocidal Zionist entity are legion. All the way back when he was the director of public prosecutions, he played a suspicious role in protecting Israeli war criminal Zippy Livni when she visited London. An arrest warrant had been issued for her in the UK due to her key role in the Zionist massacre in Gaza in 2008 and 2009. While the issues were still up in the air, Starmer met with Israeli State Attorney General Moshe Lador, and 2 months later, Starmer blocked the prosecution of Livni. The leadership campaign to push Starmer to the top of the Labour Party was bankrolled by Israeli lobbyist Trevor Chin. Sir Chin is the president of one of Israel's national institutions, the UJIA. He's also on the executive committee of Israel's largest lobby group in the UK, Bicom. Since becoming the leader of the party, Starmer has hired a former Israeli spy from the military intelligence unit 8200, Asaf Kaplan, to perform the function of social listening for the party. Labour has also accepted a £5 million donation from Gary Lubner, who has also funded the United Jewish Israel Appeal, one of Israel's four national institutions. The Speaker of the House, Lindsay Hoyle, who collaborated with Starmer on this plan of sabotage, is also very close to the Israeli regime. He travelled to the Zionist entity with the Israeli ambassador to the UK, Zippy Hotevli, and waxed lyrical about the need to support Israel in its genocidal war on Gaza. He had also previously boasted about his father, MP Doug Hoyle, being one of the founding members of the Israeli embassy proxy, the Labour Friends of Israel. It seems democracy was aborted in the mother of all parliaments with an operation hatched in Tel Aviv.
David, just say a bit more, will you, about Lindsay Hoyle and his links to Israel.
So we saw in the film there his trip with the pro-settler extremist ambassador, Zippy Hotevli.
After October 7th,
after the launch of Al-Aqsa Flood. So there's an indication. He went with Labour Friends of Israel, obviously, and he's has a long history with Labour Friends of Israel, and he, of course, has also, as he said, has boasted about his father's role in the creation of Labour Friends of Israel, which was actually, let's remember, back in the 1950s, which was created before Conservative Friends of Israel ever was, an indication of how long and how deep that goes back in Labour history. And of course, Doug Hoyle was a Blair henchman, and that indicates to us, you know, the Zionist grip on the party is extremely tight, and you can barely move in the Labour Party in Parliament now for people who have some kind of connection to Labour Friends of Israel or to the Zionist movement. It's extraordinary.
Well, I asked James what he made of the fact that both the House of Commons Speaker and Deputy Speaker in the British Parliament are friends of Israel.
Well, look, it's my wholehearted view that the role of the Speaker and indeed the Deputy Speakers is to be non-partisan. I'm aware, obviously, that the Speaker and one of the deputies were Labour MPs. They, if you like, lose their party affiliation once they take the roles. But they shouldn't be engaged in any party political pressure groups, nor should they be friends of any organisation that shows loyalty to anyone other than the House of Commons. Their job is to uphold the constitutional precedents, conventions, rules in this country, and that is the only institution that they should be showing loyalty to.
David, why, in your opinion, do you think we should be concerned about Sir Keir Starmer hiring Asaf Kaplan, who, as we know, used to work for Israel's Unit 8200, for, what did he call it, to undertake social listening for the Labour Party?
Well, I mean, this is one instance of very many of the infiltration of former, you know, 8200 operatives in British public life, in business, and also in politics. And so, of course, you know, the question is he still involved with Unit 8200? Is he still loyal to them? Does he have any contacts with them still? What is the role of Unit 8200 in the Labour Party? And more, what is the role of this social listening person in spying on Labour Party members? Where does the membership data go? Does it go back to Tel Aviv? And of course, those are the kind of questions that you would want to ask. But these are not the only concerns that there are. I mean, in the same office, it seems, until recently, was a guy called Ben Sofa, who has a senior role in the Palestine Solidarity campaign, and that's a real, real concern as well. I mean, no one seems to be asking those kinds of questions.
No, indeed. Well, James has been a student of British politics for some years, so I asked him if he thought Britain's political elites had ever been as pro-Israel as they are today.
Well, this is the age of the political nobody, in part due to the constricting party system we have in place. If you go back 30 years, MPs were well-educated, articulate, knowledgeable, and were freer to speak their mind on a whole host of issues. These days, if you call for peace among both Israel and Palestine, as a Labour MP did, before Labour came round seemingly to that view, sort of, maybe, if not really, you get suspended from the party and therefore practically thrown out as an MP at the next election. There is a groupthink mentality that has become very prevalent in both main parties, and it really lowers the standard of political discourse in this country, and the public are worse served for it. There's no freedom of expression, freedom of debate, freedom of speech in the House of Commons anymore under the party whip system. If you speak out, you get thrown out. And that really isn't how it should be.
Well, David, I wonder what you make of Andrew Feinstein, the former ANC Member of Parliament under South African leader Nelson Mandela, standing against, going up against Sir Keir Starmer in his constituency. I mean, can he really win, do you think, there?
Well, what we're seeing here is really a replication of what happened after the invasion of Iraq. And I always quote the example of the Scottish Parliament in 2003, the elections there, where 7 Greens and 6 Socialists were elected. That was a quarter of the whole Parliament was elected on the anti-war vote in Scotland. Mm. Now, it was a proportional system, so easier there, and sure, so it'll be harder here. But there's a real possibility. George may win in Rochdale, Leanne may win in Ilford North, and Andrew Feinstein, I think, has got a fighting chance here. The question is how much more anger there's going to be and whether they can dissipate any of the anger. It looks like most of their attempts to dissipate the anger so far have only exacerbated the anger. So I think, you know, we have stand a good chance of having some serious victories here.
Well, it'll certainly be interesting, for sure. Well, my final question to James was how he responded to those who claim that insurgent campaigns like George Galloway's in Rochdale and elsewhere in the country are simply empowering the Conservative Party.
Well, no party owns their voters. No party owns their electorate. Labour activists, Conservative activists, Liberal Democrat activists often throw at new candidates insurgent campaigns. Oh, you'll split the vote, you'll let Blair in. Look, our voting system in this country is pretty goddamn awful. I'm a full believer in proportional representation. But the notion that Labour owns the votes that we will undoubtedly win in Rochdale is for the birds. Every vote has to be earned at every election, one vote at a time, and that's exactly what we're doing in Rochdale. Well, look, they say it's the squeaky wheel that gets the grease, and I think anyone that has ever followed proceedings in the parliamentary chamber, whether they agree with George or not, knows that he's capable of doing far more than squeak. And let us not forget that George's views, especially on the Gaza issue, are held by a vast swathe of the British public. A large majority share the view that George has. And that is a voice that is not being represented in Parliament, with a few exceptions. The SNP group have been strong, but it is wholly weighted in favour of a view that very few people hold. And so I think a win in Rochdale ensures a springboard, if you like, for hundreds of independent candidates coming forward. Leanne Mohammed has already come forward, Shoka Adam in Leicester South. There'll be hundreds, I think, of independents, progressive independents, standing up against this duopoly that it currently serves nobody in Britain.
Well, finally, David, I mean, you know, if George does win, it looks like he's in with a good chance of winning in Rochdale. I mean, what difference do you think he will actually make? Look, he's only one person in the British Parliament. I mean, will it be significant? How will he shake things up, do you think?
Well, of course it will be significant. I mean, as everyone knows, George is one of the best political orators in the country. I've known George for some considerable years, of course, from Glasgow way back in the day, and he's been a big supporter of my work, and I've spoken on platforms with him on many occasions. Of course he'll shake things up, but it's not only about George, it's about what we build upon in relation to that. And, of course, the insurgent opposition has to be to push back against both major parties to fundamentally change their stance and to wean them away from the racist and genocidal Zionist movement.
And I think it will certainly give a boost, I guess, to other insurgent campaigns around the country if he does win. But I'm afraid, anyway, on that note, we're going to have to leave it there because we are out of time. So let me thank our guest, James Giles, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Palestine Declassified will be back next week with more forensic investigations and analysis. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
U.S. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar has said the Biden administration greenlighted the Israeli regime's massacre of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. She denounced Washington's arms aid to Israel as state-sponsored violence. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. China's Xinhua news agency has covered this story and tells us more. The United Nations Human Rights Chief has expressed dismay concerning the brutality with which the Israeli regime is leading its ongoing months-long war of genocide in Gaza. Volker Turk told the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva, Switzerland, on Thursday, 29th of February, there appear to be no bounds to and no words to capture the horrors that are unfolding before our eyes in Gaza. Tens of thousands of Palestinians, many of them women and children, have been massacred as a result of the Israeli military's onslaught in Gaza. Israel launched its campaign on 7th of October last year, following the Al-Aqsa storm operation, a surprise operation by Gaza's resistance movement against the occupied Palestinian territories. Volker Turk condemned the brutality of the Israeli response as appalling and entirely wrong. Meanwhile, the UN official warned about the pending dire consequences of a ground invasion that the Israeli regime has threatened to stage against the southern Gaza city of Rafah. More than 1.5 million of Gaza's 2.4 million plus population have fled to Rafah in southern Gaza Strip, finding nowhere else safe across the coastal sliver. Volker Turk said such a ground assault would contravene the orders issued by the United Nations' highest court. On 26 January, the International Court of Justice at The Hague, Netherlands, said Israel had to prevent the commission of all acts within the scope of the Genocide Convention. Volker Turk said, "I fail to see how such an operation could be consistent with the binding provisional measures issued by the International Court of Justice. The prospect of an Israeli ground assault on Rafah would take the nightmare being inflicted on the Palestinians of Gaza into a new dimension." Turkey's Anadolu news agency has also covered the same story. The European Union has wrapped a recent unjustifiable attack by the Israeli occupation forces on Palestinian civilians seeking food aid in the besieged Gaza Strip, calling for an international investigation into the deadly incident. In a statement on Saturday, 2nd of March, the European Union Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell condemned the restrictions imposed by Israel on the entry of humanitarian aid into Gaza and the opening of Gaza's crossing points. He said the firing by Israeli troops on civilians trying to access foodstuff is unjustifiable. Josep Borrell added, "We request an impartial international investigation on this tragic event, allowing for a clear picture of the events and responsibilities." At least 112 people were martyred and more than 750 others were injured on Thursday, 29th of February, as the Israeli military opened fire on Palestinians who had surrounded a convoy of 38 aid trucks in Gaza, with the Palestinian Health Ministry calling the incident a massacre. The latest Israeli crime comes as non-governmental organizations and United Nations experts have on several occasions voiced fears of famine in Gaza. Gaza has been completely cut off from aid by the Israeli regime since October of last year. The European Union Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell emphasized that Israel shoulders responsibility of complying with the rules of international law and to protect the distribution of humanitarian aid to the civilian population of Gaza. The top EU diplomat pointed out, "The responsibility for this incident lays on the restrictions imposed by the Israeli army and obstructions by violent extremists to the supply of humanitarian aid." Josep Borrell warned that the restrictions on the entry of humanitarian assistance contribute to creating scarcity, hunger and disease, saying it would also lead to a level of desperation that brings about violence. He added, "Unabated fighting and disregard for international humanitarian law will lead to complete chaos, making the distribution of humanitarian aid impossible." Josep Borrell stressed the need to restore a minimum of order and security in Gaza to preserve a humanitarian space. Borrell added, "We urge Israel to fully cooperate with the United Nations agencies and other humanitarian actors involved in the humanitarian response and to allow free, unimpeded and safe humanitarian access through all crossing points in Gaza." The EU's top diplomat also urged Israel to swiftly remove the obstacles at the Kerem Shalom crossing and open the access in the north at Karni and Eretz crossings, to open the port of Ashdod to humanitarian aid and to allow a direct humanitarian corridor from Jordan into Gaza. He emphasized that airdrops should be a solution of last resort given their minimal impact and their risk to civilians. Borrell also urged the United Nations Security Council to call for an urgent cessation of hostilities in Gaza. The American newspaper The Hill has also covered the same story. U.S. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar has said the Biden administration greenlighted the Israeli regime's massacring of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Ilhan Omar denounced Washington's arms aid to Israel, calling it state-sponsored violence. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar made the statement at a press conference on Thursday, 29th of February, along with other U.S. lawmakers, including Representative Rashida Tlaib, Democrat of Michigan, as she voiced concerns about the high death toll of Palestinian civilians and the displacement of over 1 million people in the Gaza Strip, criticizing the Biden administration for approving additional aid to Israel without congressional approval. Ilhan Omar said, "This administration cannot claim to be an honest broker of peace while greenlighting the massacring of Palestinians in Gaza. The restocking of Israel's arsenal is not foreign policy, it is state-sponsored violence waged against defenseless families who want only to live in peace." Ilhan Omar stressed, "If we truly want to uplift humanity to protect the innocent people of Gaza, to bring hostages safely home, to hold out hope for peace, then we must demand a ceasefire in Gaza right now." Ilhan Omar also expressed disappointment with the response from the United States and the world's political leaders to Israeli atrocities in Gaza, underlining that empty rhetoric about human rights without any meaningful action is unacceptable. The Democratic congresswoman from Minnesota said the Biden administration's policies lack effective pressure on Israel and fail to deter the Israeli regime from continuing with its crimes against Palestinians. Ilhan Omar added, "Despite the clarity surrounding Gaza's despair, the response from political leaders has been nothing short of callous. Empty rhetoric about human rights ring hollow when no action follows." She added, "This administration's policies fail to meaningfully pressure the Israeli regime through restrictions, sanctions, or any hint of consequences. Each war crime and violation compiled by journalists, human rights groups, and United Nations agencies are bearing witness."
April 17, 1917, British forces launched their invasion to capture Palestine, still part of the Ottoman Empire. The battle goes on for 3 days. The casualties on the British side are mounting. They have to retreat. London then recruits Arab tribes, promising to help them shake off the yoke of the Ottomans. With their assistance, the British raid and destroy Ottoman supply lines and logistics in the Palestine region. On the first day of November 1917, the British forces mount a new round of invasion on Gaza. Lack of ammunition and supply cripple Ottoman defense line. Gaza falls into the hands of the British, and by December 1917, they take Al-Quds, but never honor their promise. Instead, the British occupy Palestine until 1948, when they hand over the Holy Land to the Jews flooding in from across the world. The Palestinian plight and the struggle for liberation begins. On May 14, 1948, General Alan Cunningham, the last British High Commissioner, left what was known then as the Mandate of Palestine. John Marlowe wrote of the last few minutes of British rule in his book, The Seat of Pilate. The Union Jack was lowered, and with the speed of an execution and the silence of a ship that passes in the night, British rule in Palestine came to an end. On the same day, David Ben-Gurion announced the establishment of Israel. It came as a shock to the Arab world. Several Arab countries joined forces to expel the insolent newcomers, but faced a crushing defeat. A neo-colonial project, Israel systematically took over Palestinian lands, expelling people from their homes, and leaving many to live as refugees in isolated enclaves. Official records conservatively estimate that back then, at least 750,000 Palestinians were forcibly removed from their homes and lands by Israeli forces, resulting in the capture of 78% of historic Palestine. The remaining 22% was divided into the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The displaced Palestinians entered a state of diaspora, with many spending the rest of their lives in refugee camps. In addition to the conquest of major cities, approximately 530 Palestinian villages were destroyed, and around 15,000 Palestinians lost their lives in a series of large-scale atrocities. Crushed and crestfallen, the Arabs vowed to wreak revenge, take their stolen lands back, and restore their lost pride, honor, and glory. With the rise of Pan-Arabic Gamal Abdel Nasser, hope and enthusiasm came back among the Arabs. A coalition of Arab states was formed to go to war with Israel on June 5, 1967. This time around, Israel overwhelmed the coalition in less than a week. The decisive victory included the capture of the Sinai Peninsula, the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, the old city of Al-Quds, and the Golan Heights. The Arab countries' losses in the conflict were disastrous. Egypt's casualties numbered more than 11,000, with 6,000 for Jordan and 1,000 for Syria, compared with only 700 for Israel. The Arab armies also suffered crippling losses of weaponry and equipment. The Six-Day War also created hundreds of thousands of refugees and brought more than 1 million Palestinians in the occupied territories under Israeli rule. The defeat demoralized both the Arab public and the political elite. Pan-Arabism was defanged and hopes to take back Palestine were shattered. The Palestinian issue remained unresolved as an Arab problem. Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir famously claimed in an interview with the Sunday Times on June 15, 1969, that there were no such things as Palestinians. They didn't exist. Almost a decade later, in 1978, Egyptian President Anwar Sadat and Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin signed the Camp David Accords, according to which Egypt would recognize Israel as a legitimate state. A stab in the back of Palestine. Betrayed by Egypt and abandoned by the rest of the Arab world, the Palestinian nation was withering away under the illegal, brutal occupation. Two countries away from Palestine, the Iranian people were making history by toppling the powerful regime of Mohammad Reza Shah, who, like the Israelis, had the United States on his side. The fall of the Shah, who had the biggest army in the Middle East and the fifth greatest one in the world, rekindled hopes in the hearts of the Palestinians. The invincible could be vincible. In the words of the co-founder of Hamas, Abdulaziz Al-Rantisi, "We believe that the Islamic Revolution of Iran has had a positive impact on other Muslim countries. It has awakened them, and I believe this awakening accounts for uprisings across the Muslim world." The newly established Islamic Republic was, however, more than a role model for the Palestinian nation. Iran ended its alliance with Israel overnight, in favor of the Palestinians. Just 6 days after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, the Palestine Liberation Organization chief Yasser Arafat led a 58-member delegation to Tehran. As the first official foreign politician to visit Iran, Arafat was warmly received by thousands of Iranians chanting in support of Palestine. "When someone goes to their home, they do not need permission," Arafat told the public during his visit to Tehran. He declared, "Iran's revolution is a great victory for Palestine. When I entered Iran's airspace, I felt like I entered the airspace of Beit al-Muqaddas." Tehran turned the Israeli embassy to the Palestinian embassy and renamed the road in front of it to Palestine Street. An act of symbolic importance. At the same time, founder of the Islamic Revolution, Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ruhollah Khomeini, designated the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan as Quds Day, calling on all Muslims across the world to mark the day annually in solidarity with the downtrodden people of Palestine. It was a message to the whole world. Palestine is not just an Arab problem. With this spiritual assistance from the charismatic leader of the revolution, Palestine was saved from oblivion. The Palestinian plight came to the foreground. A new lease of life for Palestinian fighters to keep on their uphill battle against the occupiers. the two major Palestinian resistance groups, i.e. the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Movement, PIJ, and Hamas, officially announced their existence in the 1980s. As an underground movement, Islamic Jihad had been found in the late 1970s by Fathi Shaghari, a young physician and a Gaza refugee. Endorsing the Islamic Revolution of Iran, Shaghari said, "This revolution was a wake-up call to us all that our victory is contingent upon following Imam Khomeini's path. So it behooves us to avoid all other ways except the way shown by the Imam in our fight against the occupation regime of Israel." Tehran's ties with the Palestinian resistance groups developed steadily, even when the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein waged one of the bloodiest and longest wars in the region against Iran. Iran's closer cooperation with the Palestinian groups began in 1987 after Israel expelled Hamas and Islamic Jihad leaders to Lebanon as part of its efforts to suppress the Palestinian national leadership in the occupied Gaza Strip and the West Bank. The raging war against Iran failed to distract the nation from the Palestinian cause. The Islamic Republic expressed its deep disagreements over the so-called Reagan peace plan and the Fahd peace plan, where the rights of the Palestinians had been almost totally ignored in favor of the Israeli regime. Inspired partly by the Islamic Revolution, in December 1987, the Palestinian people staged a sustained series of protests, civil disobedience, and riots, which later came to be known as the First Intifada, or the Stone Intifada, as they were still throwing stones at Israeli soldiers who were armed to the teeth. Amid the deafening silence of Arab leaders, Tehran lent all its support to the Palestinian cause. Imam Khomeini took a clear, strong stance, saying with the Israeli regime in place, the Palestinians would not see the end of their sufferings. In 1993, Fathi Shaghari told Newsday, "Iran gives us money and supports us. Then we supply the money and arms to the occupied territories and support the families of our people." To draw further attention to the pain and suffering of the Palestinian people, a couple of years after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iranian pilgrims began staging demonstrations against Israel and its major supporter, the United States, at the Hajj. Perhaps one thing that sparked the flames of the First Intifada was a tragic incident that happened that year in Mecca, Saudi Arabia. On July 31st, 1987, during one of these pro-Palestinian demonstrations, the clash between Iranian demonstrators and Saudi security forces turned bloody, resulting in the deaths of more than 400 pilgrims. Hamas, an acronym in Arabic for Islamic Resistance Movement, emerged out of the First Palestinian Intifada in 1987. It was co-founded by Sheikh Ahmed Yassin and six others, originally as a local offshoot of Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood. On May 2, 1998, Hamas, still a fledgling group with less than a decade since its formation, paid a visit to Tehran to meet the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. The meeting happened when almost none of the leaders of the Arab world took the Palestinian Intifada seriously. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, however, had a different opinion about the struggle, the group, and its leader, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin. Iran pledged financial support and provided the group with advanced military training at bases belonging to the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps in Iran and Lebanon. It also trained Palestinian engineers to manufacture weapons locally. The Second Palestinian Intifada erupted in September 2000, after the collapse of the so-called Middle East peace talks at Camp David and Ariel Sharon's unlawful visit to Haram al-Sharif, the home of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the third holiest site in Islam. It was a major uprising by the Palestinians against the Israeli occupation that continued for 5 years. In 2006, Hamas won a huge majority in parliamentary elections, with Palestinian voters giving the group 76 seats in parliament out of the 132 seats available. After the Hamas victory, Khalid Mash'al visited Tehran and said, "Just as Islamic Iran defends the rights of the Palestinians, we defend the rights of Islamic Iran. We are part of a united front against the enemies of Islam." Unlike some other Palestinian groups, Hamas never recognized the occupation regime. So following the group's takeover of Gaza, a crippling blockade was imposed on the Strip to limit the movement of the people and goods, a collective punishment for electing an uncompromising group. To put more pressure, the US and its allies imposed sanctions on Hamas and the community the group represented. Many in the Arab world left the group high and dry, but the Islamic Republic, an all-weather friend, never withdrew its support for the group in the hardest of times. The Shia state gave a hand to the Sunni group to remind the Muslim world that Palestine transcends sectarian differences. On March 9, 2008, a Hamas senior commander, interviewed by the Sunday Times, said 300 of the group's best brains had been secretly sent to Tehran. According to the commander, who wished to remain anonymous, half are still being trained by the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. They're learning how to make explosives from everyday items and produce more effective rockets. The rest have already returned from the IRGC base in Tehran. Some have been trained as snipers. Others have learned to use tunnels in attacks on Israeli forces. Iran is our mother. She gives us information, military supplies, and financial support. The resistance movement in Palestine built up steam when Lieutenant General Haj Qasem Soleimani took the helm of Iran's Quds Force, one of the IRGC's branches with its main focus on assisting resistance groups in the region. Thanks to Tehran's unwavering support, resistance groups in Palestine grew strong enough to deal the hardest blows on the Israeli regime, something unimaginable after the Six-Day War. For the Palestinians, time for lopsided defeat had gone, and for the Israelis, victory was no longer for granted. Subsequent wars like the one in 2012 left no doubt that the Palestinians had risen from the ashes. During a visit by Hamas leaders to Iran in 2019, Ayatollah Khamenei stated, "Not many years ago, the Palestinians fought against Israel with stones. But today, instead of stones, they're equipped with precision missiles. This signifies development." Struggle against the occupation regime reached its crescendo in October 7, 2023, when Hamas forces launched a land, air, and sea attack into the heart of the Israeli occupation territories, catching the enemy off guard and shattering its myth of invincibility, in spite of all its state-of-the-art weapons and its huge military expenditure. Iran was not involved in the attack, but who can deny the country's decades-long support that molded drone flyers out of the stone-throwing fighters?
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Donald Trump is looming large in the race to succeed the outgoing Senate GOP leader Mitch McConnell. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The American newspaper The Daily Beast has covered this story and tells us more. Former President Donald Trump has quietly been encouraging Senator Steve Daines, Republican of Montana, to mount a campaign to succeed Senator Mitch McConnell as the Senate's Republican leader. Daines confirmed to Politico on Thursday following reports that he had gained the former president's support. Senator Steve Daines said he thanked Donald Trump for the vote of confidence but wouldn't say whether he was planning to follow through with a run for Senate leadership, adding, "I told Trump the most important thing I can do this moment is to make sure we have a Senate majority in November." It's the first hint to emerge out of Donald Trump's camp about the former president's preference for Mitch McConnell's replacement, and comes just a day after McConnell announced he wouldn't run for the position again. Senator Steve Daines has been Trump's preferred pick to lead the Senate GOP even prior to McConnell's surprise announcement on Wednesday. The Montana Republican hasn't been mentioned as a successor to Mitch McConnell as often as three of his colleagues who've been referred to as the Three Johns since last year. Those favorites include the current number two Republican in the chamber, John Thune, Republican of South Dakota, the former number two Republican, John Cornyn, Republican of Texas, and Senate GOP Conference Chairman John Barrasso, Republican of Wyoming. Of those three, only John Cornyn has announced his intentions to seek the top leadership position. He did that in an internal statement sent to Republican senators on Thursday, 29th of February, saying his experience as Mitch McConnell's number two should make him the most qualified politician for the job. "From experience, I've learned what works in the Senate and what does not," Cornyn said, "and I'm confident Senate Republicans can restore our institution to the essential role it serves in our constitutional republic." There's still nearly 9 months to go before the Senate will choose who succeeds Mitch McConnell, who's held the position unopposed since 2007. Unlike the House GOP's messy leadership election last year, the Senate chooses its leader in closed-door conference meetings by secret ballot. Steve Daines, who chairs the National Republican Senatorial Committee, deflected when asked about seeking McConnell's job, but notably did not say no. A source told the website Axios that Steve Daines appreciates the president's support but needs to focus on taking back the Senate in November. John Thune and John Barrasso have made similar statements suggesting that if they're to announce their own runs at Senate leadership, they will come later down the road. Donald Trump has also told those close to him that he's a fan of John Barrasso, who endorsed the former president in January. John Thune and John Cornyn both criticized Donald Trump in the aftermath of the 6th of January 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol, but they each endorsed him in this fall's election.